afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Ankton. Glad you could join us. You know, it seemed like a pretty nice honeymoon while it lasted. 2 years ago this week, new University of Minnesota president Mark Udoff arrived on the university campus during his first 20 months or so here in Minnesota. He faced the usual array of challenges that confront a university president, but by all accounts, the U was moving forward. President Udoff was receiving rave reviews from pretty much everybody, and even got a big raise. Then this spring, the other shoe dropped. The St. Paul Pioneer Press reported charges of widespread academic fraud in the men's basketball program. As the weeks rolled by, other charges surfaced. Last Friday, with the controversy raging and the investigations continuing, President Udoff announced that Clem Haskins, National Coach of the Year just 2 years ago, a man praised far and wide for his emphasis on life skills as well as basketball skills, President Udoff announced that Clem Haskins was being replaced as coach of the university basketball team. President Udoff said there was evidence of numerous, maybe even massive, incidents of academic misconduct in the basketball program, and said more changes are possible as the investigation continues. So much for the honeymoon. President Udoff has come by our studios today to talk about the situation at the U and to take your questions, so we sure invite you to give us a call here. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. President Udoff, thanks for coming by today.
Well, glad to be here, Gary. I feel like I'm still on the honeymoon. I'm getting great support in the way we resolve this issue. I'm just sad that I lost the Powerball, didn't get the Clipper cruise to the Mediterranean that the station's sponsoring. But I'll get over it.
Still glad you came here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this really does go with the turf. I mean, I called the president of Michigan State, who 2 years ago had some similar problems, and commiserated with the president of Northwestern. It's not to say the systems can't be improved and you don't need to handle these crises, but in big research universities with big-time athletics programs, unfortunately, it's just a reality of life that occasionally your institution will come under scrutiny, and you just have to act with good judgment and as decisively as you can.
Would it be easier just to get rid of those big-time programs and eliminate the potential for problems?
Oh, sure, it would be easier. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I would say a couple of things. You know, Minnesotans were surveyed. You know, more than three-quarters of them associate the university with high-quality athletics, and they consider it part of what we need to do. And no Division I school that I know of has abolished its athletics programs, the University of Chicago in the 1930s notwithstanding. The other thing people have to understand is it's a tough problem, but it is a confined problem. We have 600 athletes, 40% of them have 3.0 grade point averages or higher. Our football graduation rate is twice the basketball average. Basketball nationally is a disgrace in terms of basketball, in terms of graduation rates, 41% nationally. So we have a problem, some of which requires some systemic solutions, like I'm in favor of ineligibility in the first year. The new coach, I intend to put a provision in the contract that your compensation will partly be a function of how well your athletes do in the classroom and not just on how well they do in terms of the win-loss performance. I think there are other steps that we could take to create a much better atmosphere, but people should not be that pessimistic. This is a great university, a lot of great stuff going on, applications going through the roof, scientific discoveries. We'll get through this, we'll do the right thing, and if there are system problems, we'll fix them, and then we'll go on.
Today was supposed to be the deadline for a report on whether university officials had improperly interfered into investigations into sexual harassment and misconduct charges. Is that report out?
No. I decided to give them an extension. You know, I thought that it's more important to get the report right than to be there precisely on the day. And they had one witness who was actually interviewed for 7 hours yesterday, so they need to synthesize that testimony. I think the plan is we'll get the report on Tuesday. And then, of course, we've got to read it and assess it. And then probably later in a week we'll issue a redacted form of the report, meaning we can't reveal the names of alleged victims of sexual harassment or indeed the names of students who are accused of wrongdoing. But we'll get a report out later in the week to the media and with a set of policies that we're adopting to deal with whatever problems the report indicates.
You're an attorney yourself. Do you expect that there are going to be problems reported?
Well, I just don't think it's fair to speculate. I am an attorney, but that doesn't mean I'll leak advance information of what's in the report, sir.
All right. The Clem Haskins situation. Why did you decide to replace Clem Haskins as the coach of the university basketball team if there was no evidence that he was involved in any misconduct here? Or conversely, why pay him if there's some reason to believe down the road that he will be implicated?
Well, there's been a lot of misinformation, frankly, in the media about this, and Gary, I'd like to take the opportunity to address it. We found that we had no evidence that Clem personally had knowledge of or was in any way complicit in the writing of these papers for the students. Now, a lot of people said, how could he not know? You can ask rhetorical questions till the cows come home. But the truth is, you would have to go before a jury and say, look, there is good cause here because Mr. Haskins knew Mr. Haskins was involved in this. And particularly when Mr. Newby refused to testify, there really was no evidence to involve him. So that's the answer to the first question. We could not fire him for cause. The evidence wasn't there, period. Now, the question then is, well, should we move on to a new coach? And my answer was yes. I mean, if the manager of the station doesn't violate a law or doesn't breach his contract, he can still be asked to move on because the CEO thinks there might be a better manager out there or because things aren't going particularly well. We had evidence that, in substance, Ms. Gengelhoff's testimony on the writing of the papers was correct. I don't know whether it's 100 papers or 200, but it's a lot. And my feeling is that there's a corrosive effect, that it's eating away at our program. I think we need to do better in terms of the academic performance of our students. I thought it was time to move on. The university was being hurt, and I think the people of Minnesota expected a new change in direction. Third, on the payout, there's a lot of misinformation. A big chunk of this money was his. Deferred compensation is like a pension. You know, Gary, if you were to leave the station tomorrow morning, the employer's contribution to your pension remains yours. That was paid out last year and the year before and the year before. So about $400,000 was really his money, and all we did was turn it over to him. It was part of his compensation package. The rest was paid out because he had three remaining years in the contract. It had nothing to do with good cause. Our lawyers were not outfoxed. It wasn't that anyone was duped. It wasn't that these clauses were that unusual, although I think we could do better in drafting the contracts. We owed the man 3 years on his contract because we had no evidence that he was there was good cause, because there was no evidence that he in fact knew. And simply asserting it so doesn't make it so. Do we have documents? Did we have someone overhear him? You know, we didn't have any direct testimony. Zilch, zero. So everyone, a lot of people write me letters and say, oh, he knew, therefore do X. Well, I've got to prove that in the court of law. And my judgment as a law professor and employment lawyers we've consulted is, on this evidence, we go to a jury 3 years from now, Clem Haskins wins. Because there is no evidence. We've got to satisfy a fact finder. So my feeling was to treat the man with dignity, to treat him with respect, not draw inferences from evidence we didn't have, but to say, wait a minute, we need to do better. I'm just totally unhappy with this level of cheating in the program. I want a new direction. I want a clean program. And I frankly saw no end of it. I thought the media coverage and the discussion would go on and on. If he had a 32-0 season, it wouldn't matter, because that would be dragging and tarnishing him all the way as long as he remained as coach. So those were some of the reasons. The other reason, of course, is if you're going to make a change, you might as well make a change at a point in time where it's at least possible that you could get a permanent replacement. We may end up with an interim, I just don't know, but obviously you wait till September, October, that's impossible. The investigation will go on. We'll get a September report. Next week we'll get the resolve the allegations with respect to impeding investigations into sexual misconduct on the part of athletes, and then I don't know how long the NCAA will take, but they take whatever time they want to take is their record on this.
I was struck by a quote in a story that Sid Hartman in the Star Tribune wrote the other day from Clem Haskins, and he quoted Mr. Haskins as saying, considering the fact that the investigation hasn't shown that I broke any rules, I don't have any idea why President Udoff wanted to make the change.
Well, I don't want to comment. He said a number of things, and at one point he said he trusted my judgment about these things. But people can lose their jobs without violating the rules. In my judgment, there was massive cheating that went on, that there was a general attitude in some quarters that hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, keep your head in the sand, don't look for the infractions. I think it's a corrosive effect because the people of Minnesota, under the current leadership in the program, do not trust us to maintain academic integrity. I'm talking about men's athletics in general. That's plenty of reason to make a change. As I said, you can make a management change, even though you didn't do anything illegal, even though you didn't break any rules, but the University of Minnesota can do better in terms of graduating athletes, in terms of abiding by the rules of academic conduct, and so on. That's a decision I make, and I make that decision all the time. You know, we change deans or vice presidents. They don't have to break the law. I just say I want a different type of proactive leadership. I want a different direction. I don't want any cheating. I want more watchfulness. And I do that without saying, Mr. Vice President, Ms. Dean, you violated university rules. So that happens all the time in the world, and that's what we did.
Given that fact, can we expect other people to be let go as well, higher up in the athletic department?
Well, we're going to wait for the September report. I thought it was important to start with the basketball program itself and the person in charge. And I have two observations. One is we'll go where the report takes us, so there could be some other changes. And secondly, you have to understand that if you have difficulty proving complicity, in fact can't prove it on the part of the coach, as you go further up in line, it's even more difficult to show that someone knew or someone should have known. But I still consider it a management problem. I want different management style in those in that athletic department. I want people who are watchful for these types of problems. I want early warning. I want someone to tell me. I want Mrs. Gingelhoff to come forward to someone else and not the media and say, I think we've got a problem. Now, I mean, you know, there are circumstances here that are difficult. I mean, her position is, I cheated, no one asked me to do it, someone should have caught me. That's the way I interpret her position. So it's complex, but nonetheless, I just think we want to sort of change the environment there so it's much more watchful for this sort of thing and much more emphasis is put on academic performance. And that's what we're going to do.
Let's get some listeners involved here. Our guest this hour, University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff. And if you have a question for President Udoff, 651-227-6000. That's our Twin City number, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. And let's see here. First caller is from Rochester. Representative Dave Bishop on the line, as a matter of fact.
Well, the big kahuna.
Hello, Representative Bishop. Your phone is kind of breaking up on us, so if you could make a quick comment.
Well, Gary, I've been listening to President Udoff, and I think the first thing that struck me is that this is a quality executive decision in a very tough spot. I'm very supportive of what he said, and I think it's particularly important to attack the perception of a conflict between the integrity of the basketball and university athletics program and the quality and integrity of academics. And I think that the president's explanations are very creative, and I've been very impressed by the details that he's put forth on your program. That's what I wanted to tell him.
Okay. Thanks, Representative.
Well, Representative Bishop, thank you. I really appreciate your support, and he is a great supporter of the university. And I think he makes a profound point. We know from Joe Paterno that you can run a clean program with high graduation rates and still win. And if we can't do both, then we're going to have academic integrity. There are more important things than winning basketball games, but I really think you can do both. And we can find examples. There are a lot of pressures. It's hard. It's not easy. But I think it can be done.
And you don't think the exceptions prove the rule? I mean, it is difficult to find. Well, again, today we picked up our newspaper and another Big Ten school, Purdue, they're going to face some sanctions for recruiting violations or something.
Yeah, and there's some rumors of other Big Ten institutions. Well, I think we have a national problem. I mean, I do admit that. I mean, 41% graduation rates nationally, and But I think the NCAA, we can't do a lot on our own, but I don't want these students playing in the first year. I like to see the NBA and the NFL put some more money in farm teams. You know, if you're a baseball player, you know, you can choose between a university access to a pro career and the Spartanburg whatever's, the AAA farm team. Maybe we should start withholding scholarships if you have too high a failure rate. I mean, I think there are a lot of things to be done. And Gary, I admit it's very hard. But and I don't know what percentage of programs have the same cheating problems. And by the way, it's no excuse anyhow. I mean, you can't say, oh, the guy down the block got away with polluting the lake. You ought not to deal with me. But maybe I'm an optimist, but I think you get the right people in place and you can recruit good teams and win. But if it's not possible, then we will act with integrity all the way down the line and let the wins and losses sort themselves out.
Do you think as an academic institution, the university should recruit students who are right on the edge, marginal academic performers?
Well, it's a hard thing to comment on because you're right. You know, you recruit athletes, and your primary characteristic is not their score in the SATs or something. Just like if you have a piano program, a concert piano program, it may emphasize musical talent more. I guess I favor what we've done so far. The minimum entry standards for the NCAA, the graduation rates have gone up since those standards have been in place. Freshman ineligibility and a lot of other steps. And I think good counseling. You know, if a person can't make it, they can't. And the other thing I think you'll find is many of these students come from single-parent families, from poor areas, and they can make it. And it's an opportunity for these young people. Indeed, I would even go so far, if you go to college and 50% of them were to graduate, it's not great, but they get a college education, they get access to careers, even if they don't have that BA or BS degree. I mean, I think that's the part of Clem Haskins I admire the most, the sort of tough love that he had for the athletes and to try to move them up and improve them. So I guess I'm an access nut. We are a land-grant university. We have general college, university college, and I understand the problem, but I'm not willing to give up on some talented inner-city kids who don't test well if we have minimum standards and good tutorial, honest tutorial programs and solid rules about eligibility.
Claudia, your question?
Yes. First of all, I very much agree with what you said about the management decision and that kind of thing, and I also just want to state that my husband and I have been season ticket holders to Gopher basketball for a number of years and have been very supportive of Clem. However, I do think he needed to go. And for those people who are questioning the timing of it, how is the timing different from his being let go to that of Jim Dutcher's a number of years ago when there was a scandal that occurred in Madison? And I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
Well, Claudia, we may need to rely on Gary's memory in this. I don't remember the timing on Coach Dutcher. My timing in this case was I would have preferred, frankly, to wait till September and October till all the facts were in. But once the investigators told me, and this was their language, it was a slam dunk that we had dozens or more than 100 papers written for the athletes. I thought about that for 3 weeks. And I said this to Mr. Haskins, and I looked right into his eyes, and I have to admit, I always counted myself as an admirer of his. And I said, Clem, I don't know where this is going to end. I just don't see any way out. All this took place on your watch. The public does not accept it. The university community does not accept it. So even if the evidence is there that it seemed to me the sniping, the tarnishing, the continued erosion of confidence in the university would go on and on and on. So frankly, Claudia, I made an earlier decision on Mr. Haskins than on others in the athletic department whose conduct during this period is being examined and will be part of the report in September. And I guess my primary obligation is university, and the primary obligation of the university is academic integrity to make sure the degrees are worth the paper they're printed on.
Did, in your conversation with Mr. Haskins, did he seem to understand that he, in your mind, bore responsibility for what happened on his watch, even though he may not have, as he says, known anything about it?
Well, it's interesting. I don't want to characterize his response. I mean, he could do that for himself. But I did look into his eyes and I thought I saw a glimmer of understanding, even though he desperately wanted to coach, even though every single charge he is denied, and for all I know, every single charge does not apply to him. I just don't know. The evidence is not there. But no, there really was no response at that point. We just sort of looked at each other. Very difficult. He was in great pain because of his surgery, and I wasn't going to press the point any further.
Have you talked to him since the announcement? I guess we can't say he was fired.
No, we reached a settlement, is what we did.
Although the public seems to read that, that would be the...
Well, I'm not going to play with the words. I held more of the cards, and it is true I said in the signal that I thought it was time to reach a settlement and move on. So you can construe that as you will. But I have not talked to him. Dr. Boston has spent some time with him, and there are other friends in the university community that have... But I've not personally talked with him.
Joel, your question for President Udoff?
President, you've indicated that it seems credible that there were papers written for athletes, student athletes. And I'm wondering, if that's the case, what the implication will be on the athletes, on the students, who perhaps either hold degrees presently and had violated these academic rules earlier, or perhaps are in the process of pursuing a diploma.
Well, the I guess the somewhat simpler part of it is those who are in the process of getting a diploma, and that is we will refer the conclusions of the investigators, the factual conclusions, to the colleges that have their own judicial systems, and those students can be expelled or they can be suspended, or, you know, they have to examine each case one at a time. It's just a little bit like a mini trial, because the students have to have the opportunity to defend themselves and say it wasn't so or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure for those who have graduated. We have our legal counsel office looking into that. It'd be quite unusual to revoke degrees, but I guess I don't want to prejudice it one way or another. I taught this area of the law, but I guess I never reached a conclusion on this, and we have our general counsel looking into it. That's a lot tougher, I think, in terms of where we're going. Of course, unfortunately, or however you want to view it, many of these athletes did not receive degrees, so the point will be moot as to them.
Do you think that that kind of cheating is more widespread? In this case, in the basketball program, that is across the university as a whole?
Well, I don't know. You know, we asked the investigators to follow up every lead, and in fact, there were leads in some other sports, and when they talked to me, none of them had really panned out. If I can pan out, I mean, we found wrongdoing. And so, you know, that, like it or not, basketball seems to be a unique problem, both to the University of Minnesota and Michigan and Northwestern and Purdue and nationally. And I'll just say it outright. I just wish the NCAA would get off its duff and help do something about it. This is just going to get worse, and we need to take strong steps. And a lot of the things I'd like to do, it's hard to do because you get tossed out of the Big Ten or the NCAA. You can't just do them as a one school on your own. But I think we have not only gotten a wake-up call. You know, we've gotten the sleep alarm 7 or 8 times nationally, and I just think we need some national solutions. I think it's our problem too, and we'll clean up our program, but there's no doubt about it that there are many other schools that have encountered similar difficulties.
What do you suppose is the difference? I mean, the tendency here is to paint all the athletes with the same brush and say they're all sliding by, cheating, and so on and so forth. Yet we've got the perfect example of Quincy Lewis over at the University of Minnesota, who's graduated now, was a first-round draft choice yesterday, NBA. So a successful basketball player, apparently successful student. He was active in the student government and that kind of thing. How can a kid like Quincy Lewis do so well and so many others do so poorly?
Well, I don't have a good answer to your question, but, you know, that's why I don't like when we draw too many conclusions. You know, I mean, if you look at the women's softball team, which was an NCAA champion team, boy, I think they were up in the 90s in terms of not just graduation rates, but honors grades. So I think you have to look at it team by team. And I don't really know the answer to that question. I would say the graduation rates are lower in men's basketball nationally than they are in anything else. I mean, that's just the truth. And I think that has to do with, in part, with the fact that many times the students come from poor families in the inner cities where there weren't too many golf courses around, not too many tennis courts around. And they learn to perfect their athletic skills on the basketball courts. Maybe there are other reasons for it. I don't know. But all this jumping around, why would, you know, sports that have our athletes have a higher graduation rate than the general population of the university? These are terrific kids. Think of Kevin Nathaniel. I can't give out his grade point average. It would violate the Buckley Amendments, but it's really good. It is really good. And when 40% of your athletes are honor students, and you always tend to focus, this is no double pun intended, on the basket cases, on the ones that went wrong, you just get the wrong impression of these programs. It would be tragic to treat these young men and women in accordance with some stereotype that all these athletes, they're unintelligent, they can't get degrees, and they have a hard life. You try being out on the road and endless hours of practice and rescheduling examinations and all that, and try to pull a 3.0 average. I bet most of us are not up to it.
University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff is our guest this hour. And again, if you have a question for the president, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to some more callers here in a couple of minutes, but right now let's catch up on news headlines. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary, and good afternoon. Talks have resumed in Northern Ireland to get the peace process there back on track. President Clinton has been talking to leaders in Northern Ireland via telephone to urge them to stick to last year's Good Friday peace accord. Negotiators in Belfast are working on an agreement to form a Protestant Catholic government in Northern Ireland. German troops in Kosovo have discovered more evidence of mass killings in the region. The troops report they found the graves of 119 people in two villages in southwestern Kosovo. Locals say Serbs did the killings in March, a day after NATO started dropping bombs on Yugoslavia, and there are fears that more victims will be found. Residents in a small French resort town are mourning the deaths of 21 people killed in a cable car accident today. Authorities say a cable broke near the top of a lift in the French Alps, sending the car crashing to the ground. One official says it is the worst cable car disaster in French history. Former New York Mayor Ed Koch is being treated for a blocked artery. A close friend says Koch was admitted to a New York hospital this morning from his gym after he reported chest pains. This is the second time this year that Koch has been taken straight from his health club to the hospital. In regional news, Minnesota lottery officials are still waiting to hear from the big Powerball jackpot winner. They're waiting for them to come forward. One of the four $100,000 winners in Minnesota has come forward, but there's been no word from the big winner. Officials won't reveal where the winning ticket was purchased until the winner is named. The McKnight Foundation has agreed to pay up to $7.5 million to extend its program to help Minnesotans move from welfare to work. The foundation already has spent $20 million in 22 communities throughout Minnesota. The new money will go to the same communities. The forecast for Minnesota this afternoon calls for partly to mostly cloudy skies statewide with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, high temperatures near 68 to 78 degrees. Checking current conditions around the region, Rochester reports partly sunny skies in 69. Partly sunny in St. Cloud in 73. Duluth reports partial sunshine in 67. And in the Twin Cities, partly sunny skies, a temperature of 75. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thank you, Greta. 26 minutes now before 1 o'clock, midday, coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. Again, a quick thank you to all of you who have been supporting Minnesota Public Radio. Of course, many of you have been with us right along, but 5,000 pledges came in just the last couple of days here as we went to the end of our fiscal year. 5,000 pledges, 1,700 new members, $504,000 pledged, and we ended up getting enough money apparently to from the corporations and foundations to build a Habitat for Humanity house on the side. So it's a great deal. And if you missed it, President Udoff did not win that tall ship, clipper ship cruise that we were giving away. He's in a kind of a funk about that. Rebecca Hoffman, however, is not in a funk. She is the winner. She lives in Rochester, and our congratulations go out to her. And I thank our thanks to everybody who called in, took a shot at trying to win the Mediterranean trip. That wouldn't be a bad way to spend a couple of weeks. Or
no, that would just be great. I don't know about the pancakes on those clippers, but maybe Rebecca and I could discuss that.
Well,
I think, come along and cook up a few.
I think they've got like 72 crew members just for 172 people, so like it's you should find somebody to do that. Jerry, your question for President Udoff?
Hi, thanks. Dr. Udoff, thanks for taking my call. I know you're concerned about, rightly so, about athletic problems in the programs and raising money to become a top five public university research school, but I'm very concerned about the undergraduate education that our young students are getting. Notwithstanding what I hear that it's better than ever, I interact with many graduates of the University of Minnesota, and I think listening to their grammar, their knowledge of history, geography, and subjects that should be commonplace everyday subjects and knowledgeable to college graduates are non-existent. Hand in hand with that, I'm concerned about students who rarely see their professors, and instead they're taught by graduate students who have little or no knowledge about teaching. And that happened in my own family to two of my own daughters, one of whom graduated a couple of years ago with a math degree, and the other of whom decided to go to a smaller college so she could see a professor once in a while.
Well, Jerry, you're preaching to the choir. I think you made many powerful points, and I'll tell you what we're doing. We're trying to provide every freshman with a freshman seminar. Teach them how to write, teach them to be analytic, how to read a text. We needed 100 new positions to get that done and across the whole system. We're going to put in place about 30 under the budget that was actually approved by the legislature. But my goal is to get them all in that small group environment. And we're pushing very hard to get more of what I'll call the tenure and tenure track professors into the undergraduate program. That's a high priority. Since your daughters have left, there's been a great deal of progress in terms of class size. I'm not going to claim where we need to be, but I've made the undergraduates the first priority. And we have amazing statistics that 80% of them, 75-80% of them, are either satisfied or very satisfied with their education. My theory is smaller classes, if I can put it this way, talented professors in some areas like introductory courses, you may be able to use instructors and so forth. Stronger sense of community, get them in that we know that if they live in residence halls, they do better. We're adding 500 residence beds in on the Mississippi River so they can get the great view instead of the parking garage view. And I think we're making progress. And I would say that the type of environment your daughter moved to, that smaller liberal arts college, we can't quite get there. But that's the environment we're trying to replicate, at least by degrees. More hands-on, more you're not a social security number. Let's have a freshman convocation and all celebrate the university. Let's put more benches out there. Let's fix up the classrooms. Let's hire more professors. I couldn't agree with you more. It is the foundation of the University of Minnesota, and I think for a time we were not living up to our responsibilities. It began to change under Niels Hassimo, and I built upon his improvements.
Related to that and related to the problems with the athletic department, might it make sense to take the athletes and disperse them around the university, mix them in with the regular people so that they don't get separated off in their little enclave there?
I think it does make sense. I think, you know, I don't know the exact thing. I think you're not allowed to have athletic dorms anymore, but I'm told there are certain dorms that have a disproportional number of our athletes. That may be a good point to look into, and I'll discuss that with Dr. Boston. I also don't know what the evidence is on that, you know, whether it helps in the sense of putting them into the larger community or whether it hurts because they feel like they have less support. We've also hired a wonderful man, John Blanchard, to head the Academic Counseling Center, changed some of the reporting lines, and I'm very optimistic that he and his staff will do a better job. But I have to tell Jerry, I'm 110% in your camp, and I hope you help us next time in the legislature. We need more professors, and I've told these departments, you can get your more professors, but by God, you're going to teach those freshman seminars. I teach one. I learn more about body piercing and tattoos than I ever wanted to know, and I'm hoping they learned a little constitutional law. What can I tell you?
Ellen, you're next.
Hello, good morning. President Udall, as a graduate of the university, I certainly am pleased to about so many of the things that you have done since you've come, and want to commend you personally. But on the issue of this athletic mess, that debacle, I wanted to ask one question. I certainly feel as an African-American that the students are the big losers, those who were the athletes that were not really being... we're not forced, if necessary, to apply the same sort of work to their academic schedule as they certainly applied to their athletic schedule. But I am questioning one thing, sir, and that is, if Alonzo Newby was central, I just hate the feeling, and it leaves a bad taste in my mouth and that of many others, that it seems as though the lesser people are the ones that are being scapegoated. Gangelhoff, whether she did this work for them or not, she seems to imply, in addition to what you said, she seems to imply that she did so at what she felt was the behest of the higher-ups. Alonzo Newby, why wasn't he offered whatever was necessary, without this becoming a star-like investigation, but why wasn't he offered whatever was necessary? I think the chips should have fallen where they had to fall, and I do hold Coach Haskins, no matter how much good he has been for the community, I hold him responsible doubly as an African-American if those youngsters were in any way exploited. I just don't see how it could be without his knowledge.
Well, all I can say is that the investigators listened to Gangelhoff at great length. She thought he knew, she suspected he knew, she was certain he knew, she had no evidence that he knew. And you go into a court of law and there are evidentiary standards. Many people say it's hard to believe that all this could have gone on, and maybe that's without knowledge, and maybe that's when, and way deep in the background is one of the things that went into my management decision. But we felt, and I had plenty of lawyers looking at this, and I'm a lawyer and a law professor and taught in this area, the evidence flat out was not there. We would lose at this point unless some new smoking gun comes out or something. There's no effort to get the lower down people. Mr. Newby refused to testify. He was dismissed. If Mr. Haskins had refused to testify, he would have been dismissed with cause. If Mr. Boston doesn't testify or anybody else doesn't testify as an employee in this investigation, they are gone. The deal proposed by the Pioneer Press in the editorial is unethical. It is completely unethical for a university to buy a witness's testimony for $100,000 and $200,000. We said to him that we'll stretch the rules a little bit. If you offer this testimony, we won't dismiss you right away. We'll give you a six-month period to find a new job and so forth. That was more than fair. It's not only unethical, and if you ask any federal judge here in town, any distinguished lawyer, something that the bar should never tolerate, it would destroy the case. What would you do if Mr. Newby were on the stand and you're representing Mr. Haskins? And the first question is, Mr. Newby, did you accept any money from the University of Minnesota? How much, Mr. Newby? Did that have any impact on your testimony? I thought that was a very, very bad idea. And we tried to do the best we could. We constantly were trying to get Mr. Newby to testify. We did take the position that we can't grant anyone immunity. If the president of the University of Minnesota's piece of paper granting immunity and a dollar, you can buy a cup of coffee in most places in the Twin Cities. Prosecutors would laugh at that. The president has no authority to grant immunity to anyone. So we did everything ethical we could to preserve his testimony. We could not get him for whatever reasons that are personal to him and his legal representation. And if it were a vice president, that vice president would have suffered the same fate for failing to cooperate in an ongoing internal investigation.
There is the perception, though, President Udall, that, you know, the little people here, of course, they're getting battered around one way or another. And the higher-ups, particularly Clem Haskins, if the worst that's going to happen to him is that he leaves with a $1.5 million in his pocket, and he may have goofed up pretty substantially here, if not worse, it doesn't seem fair.
Well, Gary, you know, it's all in your predicate. If we had the evidence that he goofed up, which is non-legalese for we have cause to fire him, then I agree with you. But sitting here today, we don't have the evidence. We have evidence that some of the others did goof up. And it's often a problem. You know, if you follow these government investigations in Washington and so forth, which I admit are not a model, you know, the higher you go in the pecking order, the more difficult it is to obtain the evidence. But the rule is really the same. If we have evidence, then dismissal for cause is in order. If you fail to testify, dismissal is in order. If you have a long-term contract, and that really was the problem here, if you want to call it a problem, and that is, in 1994, everyone was very enthusiastic about Coach Haskins. And in 1996-97, he went to the Final Four, and everyone was anxious to retain him for as long as possible. And that was true in the government and the university and the people generally. So for better or worse, a 10-year contract was entered into. Then something went wrong, though not coming up to the level of good cause or goofiness under the Gary standard, and you have to pay people their contract. I don't like these long-term contracts. I'll be honest. I have tried to rid the university of them, vice presidents, deans, and so forth. I was embarrassed when I got one. I'm not sure I favor it for me because I don't think it's good. But when you recruit coaches, try to find a Division I good coach in basketball, baseball, hockey, and all those areas that has a one-year contract. I bet there are virtually none. It's just part of athletics, and it unfortunately goes with the turf.
Greg, your question, please.
Yes, this deals with what you're talking about there, Dr. Udoff. My question is, who's responsible for this type of contract? Now, I understand a long-term contract is something that would be desirable for Coach Haskins or anybody, but to have such an ironclad contract that, you know, we're talking virtually a buyout here, now, Dr. Boston, is he the one that would be responsible for this? And if this is the case, what kind of repercussions would we have for Dr. Boston?
Well, I want to say a few things, and then I'll address that. The what I'm saying is this contract was not the problem except for its duration. We didn't have good cause not only under this contract, but under any contract that defines good cause. I went to the employment lawyers. We simply didn't have a case. I didn't like this good cause clause because I felt it was too limited, but it turned out it didn't matter because we didn't have enough evidence to make it under traditional Minnesota law to terminate a contract for cause. So that wasn't, that sort of washed out of it. The second thing is, this is not a problem that the lawyers made mistakes. They knew what was in there. Decision was made in the university that this was a great coach and they would do what was necessary to keep them. And so there's plenty of blame. I don't think you can say it was Dr. Boston or someone else. People in this state wanted to keep Clem Haskins here in 1994. The government understood that. The opinion leaders understood that. The sports writers understood it. It was a very popular decision. And it was, if I can put it this way, it was the economic power. It was, let's keep a star here that produced this contract, not sort of crafty lawyering by Mr. Haskins lawyers and not sort of a middle of the night, let's concede everything. Now, I don't agree with all that. And in the contract we execute with the next coach, you better believe there'll be a more traditional clause. It'll probably be multi-year, but I'd like to keep it as short as we possibly can. And I wanted a clause in there that says the better the students do academically, coach, the better you do. So we'll try to do a lot of other things, but I think you had to be there in 94. I wasn't, but I think I understand the dynamics of the decision.
Under the new arrangement, will academic performance be as important as the win-loss record? Will it be more important? That is to say, if the kids, or the students, I should say, in the basketball program in this case, boy, they're going to class, they're doing as well as they can, clean program, and it's a disaster on the court, will that be okay?
No, I think you need both in there. I mean, this gets back to our earlier discussion. Can you get both? But both will be in there. I don't know if they'll be equally weighted or not, but contracts I've read, you know, coaches, you know, typically say, you know, depending on the sport, if you go to a bowl, such and such will happen in terms of a bonus. And I'd like those bonuses to be in there for academic performance. But, you know, we live in an age, I think, that people of Minnesota deserve better than just one. I mean, and so both things are going to be in that contract. And in my judgment, an evaluation of a coach involves the performance in the classroom as well as performance on the court. And just like we can't tolerate cheating, I think we're entitled to try to put together the best athletic program we can and win games. That gets rewarded also.
Paul, your question?
Hello, President. Thanks for taking my call. I've got three questions for you, and I'll hang up and listen.
Short ones.
Okay. Do you agree with Pat Royce's assessment that Gangloff and Archambault basically had an axe to grind with the university rather than looking out for the best interests of the U and reporting cheating? That's number one. Number two, why not make basketball a business at the school? It's a money deal, and let's face it, academic fraud is going to happen regardless of what you guys try. And number three, why not have a national forum where the people can call in and give their opinions on how to handle this? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I'll try to go through them. My feeling is that we have to examine the charges, whatever people's motive. Even people who are angry can have evidence and be right. I do think, for whatever reasons, Mr. Archambault and Ms. Gangloff were angry and did have an axe to grind, but it's our job to determine what's true, and it turns out that Gangloff in particular, that significant parts of her testimony were true. Basketball may be a money deal. The cop-out answer is we can't do something like that alone at Minnesota. It would have to be a new national rule that would allow payment of players or whatever the proposal was. I don't personally favor that, and I saw a survey. Most Minnesotans do not want gladiators out there who have no affiliation with the university, aren't students, and get paid sums of money. The National Forum is a great idea, and I think I'll just press that with the NCAA. We did have a commission that was reporting recently, though someone told me they weren't going to recommend ineligibility in the first year, that came out the other day. I think a national forum would be great. That's exactly what we need, and it would be more effective than a local forum where we're limited in the changes we can make.
Joe, your question?
My question is, what about the professors and the other academic folks at the university? Are they so detached from the intellects of these student athletes that they always fail to recognize academic fraud even when it's happening right under their noses? Or have the sports not so completely taken over the institution that they feel compelled to simply tolerate this even though they know that's going on, and what kind of safeguards could be put in place to keep this happening on the academic side of the institution? Thank you.
Well, Joe, let me just say a couple things. The nuts have not taken over, and we're trying to incarcerate them, and whatever Minnesota law will allow, executions are out of the question. We do detect cheating. We have about the national average in terms of detecting cheating. And I think when a professor says, it didn't look to me like a 19-year-old could write it, that paper, but I let it go by, that's irresponsible. That's a violation of your professional obligations as a professor. But that's a very, very small percentage of our professors. Most of them do try to uphold the vast majority do uphold the standards. You know, the issue is I'm a professor. It's hard. You know, I mean, you get a paper. I graded law school papers for 20-some years. And occasionally you'll get some internal indication that cheating is going on, or you'll see a footnote that isn't quite right, or you'll say, how can that be? You know, Mary, Jim, they were the worst student in the class. How could they produce this? But it's hard. You try grading 150 papers and try to find out that one was ghostwritten, and also they can get on the internet now, and they can buy papers there. So it's detection is very hard here, but when it's obvious, I think that our professors are grossly irresponsible if they don't do something about it. But having said that, that is not the problem. The problem is more detection than it is the professors copping out. And we're going to look at those systems in September, by the way. I just don't want them associated with the individualized blaming and vindication. But we'll take a look. If we can do it better, we will. But I think, frankly, we have the right rules. We have good enforcement, but there is a massive detection problem when you have dozens and hundreds of papers coming in to figure out which ones were written by someone else who you don't even know.
Is there any evidence that at any point athletic department officials, whoever they might be, were calling professors and saying, you know, this guy, he's got to pass that class, looks a little shaky,
Well, Gary,
we expect you to take care of this.
Gary, I don't know the exact answer. I know there were some calls that were investigated, and I think we'll find out in September whether that was the case or not. It's a difficult line. On the one hand, you know, it's nothing wrong with an athletics department supporting athletics and being their advocates, but there's a heck of a lot wrong with calling a professor and say if Johnny doesn't get a B in this test or whatever. So we'll look at that very careful. If that happened, that's reprehensible, and we'll take action against anyone who undertook to do that.
Charles, your question.
Dr. Udolph, I'm a teacher and alumnus of the graduate school, and I wanted to ask you about this. A few days ago, I believe 7 of the players who are going to be returning next year took some kind of a secret vote and then announced who they thought should be chosen as the head basketball coach. And I wondered what your reaction to that kind of action by the players is.
Well, Charles, I guess I'm a very forgiving sort. You know, I mellowed over the years since I was on the subways of Philadelphia. And obviously the players can't select their own coach, just as obviously there'll be two members of the team on the selection committee. And if they have someone in mind, we should pay attention and look into that person and see whether that person is suitable. I thought it was really a barometer on their interest in being involved in the process and maybe part of the healing process, because when I spoke to them, they were really dumbfounded and hurt, and they had many of them just love Coach Haskins to death, and this really was a blow to them. So I guess I was a little forgiving, and the way I would view it is input yes, selection no.
There were some of the players said, boy, they'd been lied to and nobody had talked to them, and were those complaints legit?
Well, I don't think so. No one was lied to, and maybe we could have kept a little bit more in touch with them. But as I tried to explain to the co-captains, I said, you know, this is not a democratic process. You know, we don't hold a plebiscite on whether someone violated the NCAA rules, or a plebiscite when a change of management is required. You know, we were doing an investigation, started in the newspapers. We took those charges seriously. So it's not a popularity contest, and I don't think they quite understood that. Maybe they're beginning to understand it a little bit more. Probably we could have done better in staying in touch with them. I would confess that. I'll have to talk to Dr. Boston and see exactly what they did and didn't do. But frankly, we knew what their position was. They love this man. They came to this university relying upon his national reputation, 1997 Coach of the Year. We knew they'd be hurting whatever happened.
Is there any reason to believe that more damaging charges are going to surface, or do you think at least the allegations are all on the table now?
Boy, I wouldn't want to put my life on the line here, but Mike Glazer, who's done many of these investigations, sort of the guru of NCAA law, says that there were fewer additional allegations in this particular contretemps than in any other university setting in which he's done an investigation. But much as I like to, Gary, I absolutely can't promise. I know of nothing out there that is of the level of seriousness beyond what we've already seen in the various allegations by witnesses and in the newspaper. But I can't promise you. Just like I can't promise the people of Minnesota there'll never be another scandal. I mean, we'll correct the systems, hire the right people. But, you know, we have tough laws on child abuse, and God knows we'd love not to have a single abused child in a year, but life never seems to work out that way. So we'll do the best we can and be tough about these things, but total avoidance or prediction of that would be irresponsible.
President Udolph, thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it.